on the basis of what we have learned, based on what you told the portfolio committee, that will then support the minister to go to the constitutional court. And where we are sitting, I think we now know that that application is missing. So we'll deal with those matters later. I don't want to preempt the outcome of the engagement of that meeting, but we'll deal with those matters later as our first four. I think now the committee's operation right now, where you are all seated, we now know that we can go beyond, even if we have to do it until the following day at 6 o'clock in the morning. It's still fine, because we're here to settle the people. When we are employed at Home Affairs, we're told to come to serve the people. So there's nothing to rush. In fact, that's the approach that we're taking. Nothing to rush. We have to work and get to the detail of every single thing. So by the time we report to the National Assembly, as mandated by the Constitution, is part of reports that are clear, clearly understood, well thought, well oversight over those reports and all of that. That's the approach that we are taking. So if you have to bear with us, I know that we are used to be this quick thing that comes to the community, you know, present quickly and with a lot of acronyms and all of that, and then it disappears. It's not going to happen anymore. It takes such time that we have another mutual president at some point after the election. Yes. For now, we're going to work in that particular approach. Right. Now, with that is the issue of the fire plate. We requested the department to give us a list of litigation. And then the last time we received a document from the department on litigation, we were going to speak on that. The reason that we have done that is because you have, where we are sitting now, in the public domain, it's known that there's a company that is suing the department for 740 or 750 million. And you must know that all those litigations, public money that we spend, right? And at the same time is that this committee of parliament has a responsibility to do oversight over anything that you do in that department. So we requested you to submit the report, and the report was submitted. You could not even read that report. The font was so small, and someone was doing it, was just doing it for compliance. I just want to put it very clear that it's not acceptable. Even yourself who submitted this report, you know it, you could not even read it yourself. It's not acceptable to submit such information to Parliament, you know, because we are really disenfranchised members of Parliament. Understand exactly what are the issues. Then the report then was sent back. We took a decision as a committee to send it back and get a proper submission. The proper submission came, but does not have the content as the previous submission. That was. Where I'm sitting, I know of cases that date back some 15 years ago when I used to chair Home Affairs. And those cases are still before Home Affairs. I know of that. Right? And then I think the information that is submitted here is not fair. But since then decide to package what you think is right for the committee to hear or to know. The rest of the issues, you have kept them under the carpet. But we'll deal with that when we come to that process. I did engage with the DG on the last item, and both, not myself, the Speaker of Parliament, did rise to both between the minister and the DG somehow. With regard to the incident that happened at the Oak Town International Airport on the members of the Southern Parliamentary Forum, the incident that happened there. So we're going to get a briefing because I did speak to the acting DG, who wrote formally that this matter must be investigated and they expect the report to Parliament so that we are able to process it correctly, and whatever the outcome it is will be guided by yourself based on the investigation that we have done. So those are the issues that are meant for the committee. Well, I've just been made aware, the last one is the VFS arrangement. You are the company that is not the last one, it's item number six, which deals with the issue of the visas. where we are sitting, we are aware that that contract is expiring in December. And we told you earlier that we know the intention is not to advertise. The intention is to proceed to give the PSF that opportunity again. And that's what I have received so far from the department, that no, in fact, we are proceeding with that. We'll deal with that issues, but I think we'll have to talk more about that area at some point. The committee has taken a position on that. In our BRRR report, we have made it very clear that we took a resolution on this matter. So we'll deal with it when the item comes for the committee later in the afternoon. So on that note, therefore, colleagues, let me allow the committee section to check if we have any apology in the meeting. The secretary will take us through any apology. And the content advisor will then start with the engagement around the union and the submissions that they have received for our CS presenter. Yeah, on that note, let me welcome you, DG, acting DG. Also, you're welcome. The acting DG was JM, JG McKay. I see the legal document that says it's JM, so I'm going to be calling him JM. Yeah. Finland, I see that you have raised your hand. Did you raise your hand?
Yes, Chairperson. Good morning.
Yes.
Anil is on his way.
Anil
is dying in the
truck. Okay, that's fine. Thank you very much. Any other apologies?
Good morning. There's no other apology that I have received.
We have a full house today. A full house today. No, thank you very much for the attendance. And welcome, Honorable Carter. And we really appreciate the work that you are pushing there. Can we therefore start with the presentation of the amendment as you have received them? Bearing in mind that both the Department of Home Affairs, the Parliamentary Legal Synthesis, they've been doing work around this piece of legislation. And then having gone through now the public submission, will then be the way forward as well as then process this piece of legislation.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, honourable members. So, in total, firstly, we have two documents that are submitted, which are summaries of all the submissions. They're titled very small at the top, submissions against and submissions in support. So, in total, there were 568 submissions. A lot of them were duplicates, so essentially just different people signing onto the same submission. What I've attempted to do is summarize it a little bit. It hasn't been hugely summarized because we haven't had a lot of time to submit to go through all the lots of submissions. However, it will give a broad overview. I'll try to highlight some of the key issues in the presentations that are here. So, just generally overviewing, we have of the 568 submissions, 65 were against first of all union board amendments, and there were 503 in support. I'm going to start with the submissions against, and then we'll move on to those in support. So what you'll see there on the submissions against Union Bill, which is there are two documents. The top of the document will say submissions in favour or submissions against. So I'm going to start with the submissions against, which is the shorter of the two documents. So we've got the submissions numbered on the left-hand side there, so you can see the total number of submissions. However, the first submission was signed by 33 individuals or organizations in support of this. And it's not a clear distinction as to which groups are bigger or larger. Each organization that submitted attests to have, however, many members, which we haven't verified. So it's not a question of the equal, like maybe just the number of submissions. There are different numbers of people supporting each of the submissions according to that organization's size. I give here some indication in those organizations where they're in their submissions indicate how, what the size of their congregation is, for instance. This is because that's something that they highlighted in their submissions that was different from the main submissions. Essentially, the two main arguments which members will already be familiar with are essentially the right to religious freedom and the right to equality. And these two competing interests are largely defined to groups either in favor or in against the submission. So without going through the full contents of all the submissions, what I will highlight for the first submission is essentially that these mostly church organizations and church congregants highlight that the bill would provide a constitutional right to religious freedom and dignity of state-employed officials because their religious convictions and beliefs, they do not see to be able to support solemnization of same-sex marriages, but would be forced to do so or suffer the consequences. The submission submits that there are viable alternatives to amending the bill, rather, and essentially what they're proposing is that there be roving home affairs officials that go to all the areas where there are less available marriage offices to solemnize civil union, such that to address the shortage of such services in more rural areas particularly. This is a common theme across all the submissions against. And what they also indicate is that the religious rights or religious mentalities of those officials who conscientiously object, that they do not leave these at home when they go to join the office or to join public life, and that this is in fact supported by the Constitution, Section 36, which indicates that there should not be any unnecessary limitation of rights, and that limitations should be reasonable and justifiable, taking into account, amongst other things, less restrictive means to achieve the same purpose. So where the judicial officers who go to rural areas ensure essentially they're saying that a less restrictive way of addressing the shortfall of civil union marriage officers is to rather have roaming home affairs officials rather than have to change the legislation. The second submission there is actually from somebody who's against the civil union bill completely. They're saying that there should rather be an amendment of the Marriage Act completely and that they shouldn't be separate but equal legislation. So this is actually somebody who's in favour of same-sex marriage and saying that the sex civil union bill is like the remnants of the apartheid era where there was separate legislation for some people versus others. So this is an interesting case of somewhere coming between for and against. So then, largely going through the submission 3, submission 4, going up to 7 are essentially all this religious objection on the basis of the violation of religious freedom and dignity. The section, submission 8 there is interesting for somebody who indicates that they were formerly homosexual and now object to the suppression of Muslim, Christian or Hindu faith as proposed in the bill. Section 9, submission 9 is also just a general a religious objection with no significant new additions, other than that they, in point 7 of that submission 9, indicate that most religions, African traditional Judaism, Islamicism, teach for the need for heterosexual marriage and the procreation of children, and the stigma attached to not producing children through marriage is ingrained in all these faiths. And saying that discrimination or to dismiss the state official marriage officer indicate that marriage was initiated by God himself, and can and that the bull tends to destroy the whole of family and society for children to be raised in a home where there's no mother or father. Then 11, 12, 13, essentially the same, based on Christian belief. 13, they like to highlight that they highlight aspects of the court ruling of the Minister of Home Affairs versus Turin in 2005, where just that implicitly stated that the conscience of state employed marriages offers should be protected. So that court ruling does in fact mention that. Then 14, 15, same, and then I think the highlight in 15 there, the last paragraph, no one should have to choose between obeying their faith and potentially suffering eternal consequences if they do not, or obeying the law and potentially losing their jobs if they do not. And it would be unconscionable for stating to place employees in such before such a choice. 16, 17, 18, 19, essentially the same. The Courts for Justice, submission 19. It's a human rights promoting public organization, which was an amicus curiae, or like a friend of the court in several cases, relating to religious rights, particularly in schools. And something I'd like to highlight on that is point 18, which is on page 6 of that submission. Highlights that irrespective of the true extent of the issue, the lack of service delivery to same-sex couples, the DHA is able to deliver services at 28% of its offices in answer to the need of less than 1%. So the statistics they provide indicate that less than 1% of marriages are conducted by are provided to same-sex couples or non-heteronormative couples. And that of the staff contingent of 1,100 marriage offices, 62% are willing to register same-sex unions. In answer to that, less than 1%. So essentially they're saying that the DHA has an oversupply of marriage offers. Offices are willing to register the same-sex marriages. And essentially that the problem is not the bill, the act, but rather the logistical planning of the DHA, and that they should address this by better planning and reallocating people to places where there are shortfalls. And also, they then indicate on point 29, which is on page 7 of the submission, of the summary of the submission, that they indicate that it might be possible that some of the people who object to solemnizing same-sex marriages are in fact bigots, but there are also sincere conscious objectors, and it must be accepted that marriage officers who are conscientious objectors are not motivated by desire to prejudice or harass others on the basis of their sexual orientation, but rather to live in accordance with their sincerely held beliefs. Point 30 in that submission also indicates that the Bill of Rights may be limited in terms of law of gender application, but that the limitation needs to be reasonable and justifiable in an equal democratic society. And the limitation of rights entails a balancing exercise, which is the purpose to maximize promotion, protection, and enjoyment of rights of all persons. Therefore, at least in the least restrictive manner, to limit the rights is to be preferred. And this again in support of broken Home Affairs offices. Then I'll skip forward to point 47 of that submission, which is on page 9, indicating that 267 out of the 382 Home Affairs officials objecting to solemnizing civil unions indicated that there are significant amounts of people living in accordance with their religious beliefs, and that the location of where these home affairs offices are, being rural, KwaZulu-Natal and Eastern Cape, also suggests that cultural these results in married, family, and intimate partnership relations are important to many marriage officers. And then point 48 there, unfairness of discrimination does not reside in granting of a right to conscientious objection to marriage officers. Rather, the cause of unfair discrimination is geographic and budgetary in nature, and following from a lack of proper planning by the public public authority. Then on page 10, point 51 there indicates that South Africa is not a secular state. Constitution welcomes religion in the public sphere. The state is obliged to reasonably accommodate the existence of freedom of conscience, religion, and belief of married officers who object to compromising. I'm going to skip down to point 57 there. I would essentially just the geographic point again, that essentially it's just a bad distribution of planning on account of the DHA and not prima facie discrimination. Going forward to point 65 on page 11, part of their suggestion there is that the DHA publish a schedule of days in which roaming marriage officers can attend to specific home affairs offices. It may provide mechanisms where same-sex couples can make a special request for roving marriage officers to attend a specific home affairs office at an earlier date. Although it's possible that same-sex couples might experience very slight delays in service delivery, they will be able to solemnize their civil unions at home affairs office of their choice and would not be deprived of their constitutional rights. And then, going on to point 67 on the conclusion there, the Constitution requires that rights be balanced in a manner that is fair and maximizes the enjoyment of the rights of all persons. In order to achieve this, the reasonable, practical, and simple solution is providing roving marriage officers. And that this balance is essentially conflicting rights of the same-sex couples and marriage officers. Same-sex couples would be able to exercise their rights and have their civil union solemnized, while the rights to conscientious objection of marriage officers would still be preserved and not permanently extinguished. So that's aspects of that submission, with the references to various international experts and more various research supporting it. Then I'll go on to submission 21, which is freedom of religion in South Africa. Again, religious and rights-based organizations. There I'd like to highlight point 10 on the page 12, which indicates that the inclusion of section 6 in the Supreme Law was not a legal blunder, as has been argued by some, but that the conscious objection clause was specifically written into the Act by Parliament following the recommendation of the Constitutional Court in Minister versus Faree, on the principle that reasonable accommodation could be applied by the state to ensure that civil marriage officers who had sincere religious objections to officiating as same-sex marriage would not themselves be obliged to do so if this resulted in a violation of their conscience. Okay, they also propose the roving marriage officers to address this. Point on page 13, point Roman numeral 7, there indicates that it is submitted that having a dedicated state-employed marriage officer in same-sex couples having the union solemnized may even result in them having their union solemnized much quicker than in the case of many heterosexual couples who have to patiently wait their turn. And they're also indicating on point B there, under the assignment of employees to specific offices on Roman numeral 2, that an affirmative action-based approach could be used to address this issue, that rather than dismissing home affairs officials who were not willing to comply with same-sex solemnization, they should rather be progressively replaced by home affairs officials who are willing to do such marriage, such unions. thereby so because surely eradicate the discrimination. So then I'm going to move on to submission 24, which indicates that in the third paragraph there, that the right to freedom of belief and the right to human dignity cannot be separated. And in relation to a Justice Sachs ruling, the right to believe or not to believe, and to act or not act according to one's beliefs or non-beliefs is one of the key ingredients of a person's dignity. So it's an arguing in favor of dignity and religion being related. Then 25, 26, all the same, essentially. And then going to submission 30, which is from a combination of the Evangelical Alliances of South Africa, which came to represent 4 million evangelical Christians in South Africa, and the Marriage Alliance of South Africa, which is a Christian association supporting the protection of the institution of marriage, which came to represent 20 million South African Christians. And they were advocates of theory, also a friend of the court in the Minister of Home Affairs versus Shree Court, which basically led to the Civil Union Bill, the Civil Union Act. What I'd like to highlight there is submission or point 2.1 there on page 15, which indicates that the tens of thousands of submissions were made to the committee, the portfolio committee in 2006, respecting the Civil Union Act was thoroughly considered by Parliament before it was enacted. Section 5 and 6 were the product of an outcome of many submissions by people of faith. And a simple removal of Section 6 without further public hearings in all provinces will fly in the face of public participation in 2006. 2.2, I'd like to highlight there, just aspects of the Shree court ruling was that LGBTI groups on the one hand and religious communities on the other, there's a balancing act, I think, exactly between them. And the judgment notes that both contesting groups are citizens of South Africa are entitled to be protected by the Constitution. More importantly, the judgment calls for legally justifiable sharing of the common space, which is the public sphere. In an open and democratic society, contemplated by the Constitution, there must be mutually respectful coexistence between the secular and the sacred. The function of the court is to recognize the sphere which each inhabits, and not to force one onto the other. Then I'd like to just look at the last paragraph on that page 15. The Constitution between the sacred and the secular, the fact that the open and democratic society is contemplated by the Constitution. Although the rights of non-believers and minority faith must be fully respected, the religious beliefs held by the great majority of South Africans must be taken seriously. As the court pointed out, Christian education, freedom of religion goes beyond protecting the inviolability of the individual conscience. For many believers, their relationship with God or creation is central to their activities. Concerns their capacity to relate in an intensely meaningful fashion to their sense of self, their community, and the universe. For millions in all walks of life, religion provides support and nurture and a framework for individual and social stability and growth. Religious belief has the capacity to awaken concepts of self-worth and human dignity, which form the cornerstone of human rights. I then go to the next page on point 2.3 there, that being compelled to solemnize same-sex marriages was not part of the terms and conditions of employment. By unilaterally changing the terms of employment, the state employer would be committing unfair labor practice and open up the state as the employer to deluge of litigation at the cost of the taxpayer. Then 32, 33, essentially the same arguments that they've So that's just in brief overview the arguments against. More specific details obviously included, and shouldn't take too long to read through the summary of each submission. So I'm going to then move on to the submission in favour.
I think that's how we should approach it. that line, it still calls us back into that 2007, Louis Samadou, when we still dealing with the 6 billion engagement, and those experiences are back again. But that line is the line that guides us in anything that we do. So on that note, let's allow Adam to then get those comments to make it right. Let me give
No, it's correct. I fully agree, Chairperson. But I just wanted to check whether representatives of workers from Home Affairs have they put across a view. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, both in terms of individual submissions from marriage officers themselves, which are indicated in the against submission, in the data. There were 3 submissions from marriage officers themselves. Indicating their personal objections to being forced to do these marriages. But then also Kasatu, which represents the biggest worker union in the country, makes a submission in support of the bill, saying that non-discrimination is part of substitution. So there are aspects of both from both parties. Support of the
Adam can then proceed.
Okay,
so let's receive the second document. I think we have noted the first document, and then let's receive our members in position of the second document.
Yeah, it's the submission in favor of the remaining bill, at the top of each page.
It's
about 36 pages long. So slightly longer and more detailed than the initial submission, or the initial summary. So what we have there is there are 3 main submissions which got significant co-signatories to them. So if you look at the first 3 submissions, what we have there is 64 signatories to the submission 1, and then on page 2 there's 139 signatories to in support of submission 2, and then submission 3 there's 230 signed hard copies of submission 3. So we didn't have time to go through writing down the individual names of those persons, but they're available to members who require them. So everywhere else I've mentioned the name of the actual submission persons or organizations. That one we haven't gone through the individual names, but there are 230 signed copies submitted in support of a free gender submission. So then going to highlight again of all the submissions. In submission 1, point sub 6 there, I think members are already familiar with Honourable Carter's arguments in general, so I'm not going to go through them in a coherent order, but rather just highlight some of the pertinent aspects. So point 6 on page 1 there is that state officials have a fundamental right to be whatever they like. That public servants should not be able to pick and choose which laws they will follow and which services they will provide. 7, we are sympathetic to the potential labor implications following the possible repeal of Section 6, and that staff might reasonably object to conditions of service being changed. However, there is no impediment to any new job applicants being asked to affirm that they will indeed provide the same services to citizens in the future. Then going on to page 2, the 139 signatories. The second paragraph there, that section 6 allows for prejudice against same-sex couples by marriage officers by giving those officials grounds to object solemnizing of unions. No such allowance is made for any other factor, bar for sexual orientation. So nothing on gender, nothing on religious orientation or a cultural group or race. Only sexual orientation, so this is the one exception to the otherwise the non-discriminatory legislative regime. And then the 230 signed copies on submission 3, the biggest supported submission by and large, has 3 main arguments, essentially on the importance of equality. On page 3 you'll see the arguments in favour of equality, B in favour addressing issues of religion, and C the balance between religion versus prejudice and homophobia. So what I'd like to highlight there is under A.7 married, same-sex couples that are poor cannot afford to travel to different offices. Section 6 could prevent poor same-sex couples from getting married. Then on the point of religion, constitutional courts that would be out of order to allow religious beliefs and values of some to guide the constitutional rights of others. The state is separate from individuals' personal religious beliefs, and individual personal beliefs should not determine who receives services from government. Then point 10, under religion versus homophobia, and the point indicating that there's no way of knowing for sure if the officer refusing to marry same-sex couples really holds a religious belief or simply does not like LGBTI persons. And in conclusion there, point 13, in solidarity with promoting equality and dignity for LGBTI persons and everyone's right to marry, they you know, therefore make the submission. Submission 4, what I'd like to highlight is the last sentence there on page 3. A4 of these submissions indicated their support of the repeal of Section 6 of the Civil Union Act. Of these submissions, and only 17 of these submissions did not support the bill. So this was in relation to the draft bill submitted by Honourable Carter. Then on page 4, what I'd like to highlight there is on under point 5, there by this pre-gender organization, which made both their own submission and also kind of piloted the most important submission that they've done, that the Legal Resources Center has done extensive research and made a report on such matters that members could refer to should they wish to. Point 6 there.
I just want to do some small intervention. That maybe what we should do is that the documents then get to the committee as it prepared. And then we move to the electoral amendment. The reason that I'm trying to keep the issue of time for the electoral amendment. The civil union, I know it's agent, but the electoral amendment becomes very, very agent. Already work has been done there at the level of the electoral amendment is to push for the motion of disability, having done the rest of the issues that we have to say. So I thought we should pause here. On the submission. We'll still further proceed with that because the issues that are raised as the second statement are in line with what Congress Carter has proposed generally. So that's what I wanted to propose, colleagues, that because I'm looking at, we're now at 20 past, say, 10. We'll have to wait 30 minutes. Well, unless we do 10 minutes and then come back and do the remaining 30 minutes. But we said one to adjourn before 11 o'clock so that the venue can then be prepared for the engagement of the next meeting. So I wanted just to, the member said that we just received the document, they will have enough time on our own to go through the document again. There's nothing wrong to do that. Then we can then begin to prioritize what must be done because I want from here, having agreed on the issues of the electoral amendment, there are processes that need to be engaged on.
Chair, I don't mind your proposal. I just wanted to ask how much longer do you think it will take for us to just conclude what we're doing at the moment?
No, it's quite a very thick document, by the way, if you have one of it. It says we've written 15 minutes, then we only have 10 minutes. The electoral amendment. Well, why do we have to? Why do we have to rush ourselves to that extent? Let's hold it here. We'll then proceed with the process later. I mean, by later it means that you may, unless you want us to proceed and close this matter, and then later still go back to the electoral amendment. If colleagues are saying that, then it's fine.
Chairman, I suggest that we just try and you know, just conclude with what we have to do as quickly as possible. If that's not possible, then we're going to have to come back. But
let's do this. Let's allow Adam to present and finish the Old Testament. We'll be left with 10 minutes. When we start the meeting later today, we're going to start with the electoral amendment. For another, and you must know that we have invited the minister to come later and not consulted to share with him any other engagement after here. Because there must be consultation. We'll have to attend that. Failure to which the committee will finish that later. We'll finish it at 10 o'clock or 5 o'clock the following day. I don't have a problem with that. I'm trying to make things clear. Let's proceed, Adam. But bear in mind that the later meeting may not be possible because we have not checked the system after that engagement of what you have. Proceed, Adam.
Thank you, sir. So then on page 4, just making reference there to, there's a link to a document with extensive research in support of this organization, which is Free Gender. Free Gender is primarily a black lesbian organization based in Khayelitsha. What I'd like to highlight in their submission is point 13 there, that's unjustifiable, a violation of the right to equal protection under the law and under section 9.1, and to not be discriminated and unfairly in terms of section 9.3 of the Constitution. And also indicating that based on their experience, but also just historically, there is a legacy of severe historic prejudice against same-sex couples, which requires specific intervention in terms of also protecting their constitutional rights. Point 15 there, affording same-sex couples the right to marry does not in any way lessen the capacity of heterosexuals to marry. So there's not a contradiction in those decisions. Point 16 there, that the court found that providing same-sex couples the opportunity to marry in the same way as done by heterosexual couples was not in allowing such was a violation of their right to dignity in terms of section 10 of the Constitution. And then moving on to page 5, I'd like to look at point 20 there, the second sentence, where rights and obligations associated with marriage are vast and include the duty of support, the right to inheritance, medical insurance coverage and adoption, access to wrongful death claims, spousal benefits and bereavement leave, amongst others. And that the court found that the need for affirmation and protection of their intimate relations as human beings is somehow less than that of heterosexual couples if they don't have equal access to such services. This exclusion further signifies that the capacity for love by lesbian and gay persons, commitment and accepting responsibility is by definition less worthy or of regard than of heterosexual couples if they're not afforded equal rights. Point 21, that it's out of order to employ the religious sentiments of some as a guide to the constitutional rights of others, and that there must be mutually respectful coexistence between the secular and the sacred, recognizing the sphere in which each inhabits, and not forcing one onto the other sphere, provided there is no prejudice to the fundamental rights of any person in this group. Point 22, the last such sentence I'd like to highlight there is the regardless of their sexual sincerity, religious beliefs opposing same-sex couples from marrying cannot, through the medium of state law, be imposed upon the whole of society, and in a way that denies the fundamental rights of those negatively affected. They also mentioned the separate but equal legacy of the apartheid regime, which in which the separate law essentially was a repudiation by those in power of the groups subjected to segregation. So they in fact also indicate that even the civil union law, as qualified without Section 6, is still a separate but equal legislation, but that we're moving towards more inclusive legislation by excluding Section 6. They also indicate later there that separation implies repudiation. It connotes a distaste or inferiority and perpetuates a caste-like status that becomes constitutionally invidious. and that legislative remedy is chosen must be as generous and accepting towards same-sex couples as it is to heterosexual couples. That's from the court ruling as well. Section 24, indicating essentially that there's continued marginalization of same-sex couples, despite the civil union bills, and so they haven't gone far enough. Point 26 on the bottom of page 25 there, the last two sentences, that there's no requirement in section 6 to of a sincere religious objection, and that any measure of establishing whether objection may be motivated purely or in part by prejudice or stigma against LGBT persons is not possible to determine. That same-sex unions as the only reason a civil officer may object, meaning that it endorses the discrimination of by state officials on the basis of sexual orientation alone. Point 27.1, there are a number of their personal experience of what has happened in the gender organization, that couples are sent away from certain home affairs offices because there's nobody available. Some complained about being asked to return on a different day. Some had to approach different offices. Others were forced to identify each other as husband or wife, with similar insensitive heteronormative concepts. Then 28.2, they've submitted also with the submission a list of marriage offices and of the marriage officers that are willing to conclude same-sex marriages in DHA, and that these are very limited. The statistics or the summary of these marriage offices is one of the latest submissions which I'm going to. 28.3, there I'd like to highlight that 421 of the 1,130 marriage offices in DHA objected to concluding same-sex marriages. 37% of marriage officers objecting essentially. However, what this allows the state to do on point 30 there is that officials refuse to offer service to one group while offering exactly the same service to another group. That this is the grounds of prejudice. Point 31 there, second sentence, is it's far more difficult for same-sex couples to conclude a marriage than it is for heterosexual couples. In addition to encountering resistance from family, colleagues, and friends, they have to deal with barriers and limitations exposed by the Civil Union Act. Same-sex couples are denied the certainty, excitement, and comfort that heterosexual couples experience in regards to finalizing marriage. Point 32 there, the third sentence, same-sex couples can therefore never be sure on the date of their appointment to get married at the DHA offices. They will in fact have to be married, and there's an additional burden they must overcome in relation to religious exemptions of the marriage offices. And the ability of non-religious marriage offices to obtain solemnizing marriages did not exist before the enactment of the Civil Union Act. So there was no, prior to the introduction of this, there was no discrimination as to which marriage office or which union marriage offices could and could not engage in. Point 35 there, they just mentioned a number of different international cases in which countries have taken steps to ensure that civil union of various sorts are implemented uniformly. So they mentioned examples from Australia, Argentina, Brazil, New Zealand, Germany, England and Wales. What I'd like to highlight is from Brazil, where they indicate that a resolution prohibits any public authority from excusing themselves from finalizing same-sex marriages, and this is binding on the judiciary and employees of registries that solemnize marriage. The Belgian example indicates basically they have non-discrimination law, which prohibits the grounds of sexual orientation as a basis for discrimination. religious marriage officers may be allowed to choose whether or not they will perform same-sex marriages or unions. So we also have this distinction in South Africa. Those who are civil servants who provide civil unions, and there are marriage officers who provide religious ceremonies, both of which have legal recognition. So then what I'd like to highlight is point 39 there on the bottom of page 7, is marriage officers employed and designated by the state in terms of Section 2 of the Marriages Act should perform their services and duties without favour, discrimination, and equality. Point 14, that we should reject deep-seated patterns of past discrimination and continued homophobia, and that 41, that sensitisation training of VHA officials is necessary to facilitate positive service delivery for all persons, especially for the LGBTI persons. Moving then on to Section 5, is the sensitivity and support, Submission 6. What I'd like to highlight in Submission 6 is point 5 there, which indicates the given international rise of churches like people like King Davis and the county clerk for the Rowan County in Kentucky and Westboro Church, fearing where South Africa may end without an amendment to Section 6 of the Civil Union Act. These were, if maybe people recall, these strong anti, strong homophobic and racist Christian groups in the US. Point 7, this is a Christian in support of civil union, and essentially arguing that we're all created in the image of God, and that it's unacceptable for people working in the state to be given a choice to discriminate based on their beliefs, and that we should be protected against discrimination. Then 9, 10, 7, 8, 9 in support, generally. Point 10, essentially that same-sex couples have been enduring discrimination for hundreds of years. The young gay man and that in the discharge of their duties they are only acting as representatives of the state. In other words, they are not individuals, but rather a vessel of the state. Point 11, what I'd like to highlight there is bullet 1, that homophobes, employees of public servants, paid by all taxpayers, they're not funded by only taxpayers who share the same perspectives as them. Bullet 3, any employee who refuses to perform these duties should either find alternative employment outside of the department or should change their role. Bullet 4, all law-abiding citizens should be treated equally, irrespective of their beliefs, to prevent denigration to the apartheid state where the issue is similar to the apartheid state, and that all bigotry is bigotry, irrespective of the kind of bigotry it is. 12, 13, 14, also this is generally in support. What I'd like to highlight on Submission 15, this is the individual experience of somebody who was married in the Nigerian office, a former member of parliament, indicating that their experience has always been good in the cities, but that this is not the case for LGBTQI couples in more remote aspects of the country, or parts of the country. Particularly experienced women in Khayelitsha who were asked irrelevant, offensive, and discriminatory questions when they tried to apply to the union. Then 16, perhaps on the top of page 11, the last sentence of the second paragraph there. So why should a state official be allowed to decide who should and who should not be allowed to formally declare their love for one another? And if such official truly does have a deeper moral objective to doing their job, they're fully welcome to resign and seek employment themselves there. 17, 18, 19, all the same. Going on to 19, this is a kind of a more academic inquiry into international human rights law as it relates to discrimination around the world. The useful aspect of that submission is to get a reference to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and various international law. And in fact, that There's also various court cases relating to same-sex marriage that are referenced and supported the bill, which is quite interesting to read through. But essentially what they're saying is that the domestic framework in South Africa, in fact, goes further than international instruments, in that it explicitly provides that sexual orientation is prohibited, that sexual orientation is a prohibited ground for discrimination. So we're in fact go beyond international laws in our constitution. So then I'd like to go mission 20. We can skip forward to 16, 17. Okay. Submission 35 on page 17 from Kusatu. That they understand that marriage officers were allowed to opt out of deciding of same-sex marriage when the Marriages Act was amended to allow same-sex partnerships due to its religious and cultural sensitivity. However, we believe that society has since evolved and the Act must be amended accordingly to be in line with the Constitution. It's important to note that LGBTQTI communities frequently experience serious discrimination in many forms. It's important to note that we also continuously seek to combat and further advance and deepen the constitutional rights of South Africans. The bill will be an important progressive step in this direction. And then the next paragraph, the SARS and its affiliates represent more than two-thirds of public servants, including those officials past resided in marriages. We will work with the SARS and our affiliates to sensitize our members on the need to reflect the values of the Constitution and to educate and prepare them to implement the progressive objectives of the bill once enacted into law. Section 36, what I'd like to highlight is the last part of that first sentence, that public officials, the public servants who refuse this service to be delivered to me as a taxpaying citizen of South Africa and the law of our constitution is discrimination, unjustifiable. 37, 38, 39, all the same. Going on, the next submission I'd like to highlight is on page 20, paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4, where the second sentence indicates civil society organizations equally raise concern about section 6, most notably the joint working group. This is in terms of the draft version of the bill. The joint working group specifically stated that they object to allowing the conscientious objections of public officials based on purely on a couple of sexual orientation. They reiterate that section 6 reinforces discrimination against same-sex relations, which is exactly what the constitutional order ordered the state to address. However, retaining the legislation was part of the National Assembly. So this is in relation to the initial so just indicating that the civil society is engaged in those emissions. We can then move to submission 53 on page 22, which is the submission from Lawyers for Human Rights. This provides a good overview of on the issues in general. And what I'd like to highlight on that submission is on page 25 on that page, 25 on the towards the bottom there, in terms of balancing competing rights in an open and democratic society. As they argued in support of, or as they use as evidence of support, section 6 of the Civil Union Act unreasonably limits the quality and dignity rights of same-sex couples by extending the religious rights of officers of the state to more than their justifiable limits. And notwithstanding religious belief, the Constitutional Court has previously held that the right to religious belief, conscience, and practice, the supposed purpose of the limitation, is an insufficient reason to limit the rights to equality. And then the next paragraph, that the primacy of the right to equality in our law has been confirmed several times. The primacy of equality equality over religious freedom. In particular, there was a court in the equality case, in the case in the equality court, relating to a guest house which refused to serve the same-sex couple, and their argument in terms of having a religious objection was overruled. Essentially, that's a case law precedent exists to take equality over religious freedom. So I highlighted that submission, and then if you go to the top of page 27, there's the highlight of the research that this NGO has done, Gender Justice, which indicates the amount of marriage officers and those who are willing to conduct civil union. The main cause of concern there obviously being the Eastern Cape Free State in Mpumalanga, where less than 20% of the homosexual officials are in fact willing to conduct civil union. Then, if we can go to I'm not meaning to rush this, but I have just highlighted essentially where there are different aspects or unique aspects of the submission. So page 32 there, on the bottom, conclusion under point 9, is that first consider the proposed repeal of section 6 of the bill, which the Helen and Susan Foundation endorses. For consistency, one further technical recommendation is made that is submitting the word shall for may in section 4.1 of the Act. So there's a proposal for technical amendment to the civil union bill to make section 4 in compliance with section 6. Because currently section 4 allows for that marriage officials may conduct the civil union, whereas now they should say shall, so it's not going to cause irregularity and contradiction in the bill. And secondly, more broadly, they indicate that the part of the issue is the complicated system which governs marriage of both same-sex and opposite-sex couples in South Africa, and that they in fact argue for adoption of a more simplified, more secular, unified marriage law to kind of cohere all the different current marriages, so you have the customary marriages, civil unions, normal conventional marriages. And also Muslim marriage, so they're advocating for a wonderful model for everybody. Then I back go to the submission. Okay, well, just the last submission there, just another indication from a guy, couple indicating that they've had terrible experiences trying to get married, and that nobody should be submitted to such humiliation. And then essentially everything else, largely overlapping arguments for the political class of submission.
Thank you very much. Let us firstly appreciate the work done by the content advisor, who has really work very hard to consolidate all the submissions. Now, colleagues, we have two submissions now. I mean, not two, but we have submissions that we have received from the public. And the position that we took was that we're going to allow for public submission. We do not agree that we'll take the bill to the public committee, but we wanted public written submission. Then here we have now received that, which is an option, obvious, generally, like the Committee of Parliament have. So we opted for the written submission and the response to what we have. Can I therefore propose maybe hear comments from members, and then we'll then deal with the way forward after the comments from members. The parliamentary advisor, I'm not sure that they have had the size of the submission. you may want to comment on the submissions received so far, but let me first start with members and then we'll then deal with the way forward. Comrade Putin?
Yeah, earlier on, when it came, I did indicate that we expect this written submission from the different stakeholders, and therefore the question can go and interrogate, because it's a constitutional matter, and we will take the issue further. Thank you.
Raul Kata, you've raised your hand. Do you want to make a comment on the submission? I wonder, I think the point of Mamra Putin is clear that we may have to then go deeper into the submission so that we don't just treat them as, you know, submissions just rush to the amendments without really having to debate each one of them at some point. Is it correct that maybe, let me invite a comment from the parliamentary advisor. So far, and then at the same time we can then do the process moving forward. Yes. For record again, just introduce yourself just for record.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning to everyone. My name is Noluthando Bekashe and I'm the parliamentary legal advisor. Chair, I received the submissions and I had a look at them. They raise very important issues, and by the look of things, there are conflicting rights that are being raised, the right to religion and the right to equality. So, Chair, I would appreciate if the committee could give me time to make a presentation, a thorough presentation, trying to balance the two rights and also present to the committee what the Constitutional Court has said in balancing the two rights. So, Chair, I guess process-wise, we would need another meeting where I would have to respond to the submission, because most of the issues that are raised are legal and constitutional issues. Thank you, Chair.
Mamu Ngomo, but thank you very much. I think the point is noted. In fact, there is before we go on as to how we want to process the submission. Mamu Ngomo?
Thank you very much. Chairperson, thank you.
Yes.
Chairperson, we seem to be in need of, should I put it like, well-structured time. Time is not really on our side. So with your guidance, Chair, over the legal advice, which now has been brought up and which we need, we will definitely need that. But even on our own side, how much time would we need? And I must say, Chairperson, to others, that having listened to the input as well as how he has worked on the matters, I must really thank your content advisor, Chairperson, for the work that he has done. But Chairperson, time-wise, how do we move forward with this process?
Yes. That's fine. So this, can you agree? My brothers can come in before we sort of have come to.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. I mean, this issue raises several constitutional matters from both sides. And so I would support the proposal that we do get a presentation from the State Law Advisor regarding that. But I don't want to delay the matter indefinitely. We've got to deal with this matter as quick as possible, but while doing due diligence to it. So I'm not saying we have to rush through and not apply our minds, but I'm not saying we should delay it indefinitely either. So I would like to support Honourable Nkomo, I'd like to know exactly the timetable we're looking at, so we can all have it in our minds when we're going to be dealing with this matter. Thank you.
No, colleagues, I note your comments, but the honour again is on members to go through the submissions and make your own comments. I know legal advice is coming to guide and help us with the balance, but members have a responsibility, therefore, to engage with the submission. Now, what we then propose is that both the parliamentary legal advisor and the department, Gideon, working on this and particular amendments. Next week will then come and give us the guide on what we have expected from the submissions that we have which can highlight the issues that they require further engagement, and guided by that balance that we spoke about, that fundamental right that is entrenched in the Constitution of the state may not discriminate on what's called sexual orientation. And that's the bottom line. So we'll give them that that work to do, and then they'll come back next week. We'll come back next week because we still have next week again. So this will then be presented again next week. On that note, the issue of the next bill on the IEC, I'm going to propose that we then adjourn here. We'll deal with the rest of the issues when we come back later. But again, I still have to check with the minister for the thing, because we have scheduled the minister exactly at our first call. I do not want to start with something outside what we have agreed upon. So I'll consult with the minister and find out if it's available for later. Other than that, we engage the minister and then we finish later and rest up in the morning with the last item in the agenda. On that note, colleagues and officers from the department, and let me formally welcome the minister, who came in very quietly when we reviewed your review of the engagement. You're welcome, minister, and the presentation is welcome for you. On that note, the meeting is adjourned. Until after 4, same venue here. Thank you very much.